welcome back to another podcast. Dr. Jerry Burkett here with you. Welcome back to the Project School Leadership Podcast. Now, I produce this podcast primarily for my students. In fact, for those of you who are watching, to my right, I actually have a podcast studio that is being built. I have the equipment for it. I haven't got it fine-tuned so that it works, even though this seems to work just fine. It's just kind of overwhelming right now. So what I'm hoping to do is just improve this whole podcast thing that I'm trying to do, because what I'm studying is, as a professor, I'm studying the impact that podcasting can be used as a pedagogy. So as a way of teaching and reaching students. And so I'm looking at that. And so if you're in my class, if you're in my 6433 or my 5323 classes, I'm going to be sending out a survey very, very soon. And if you've been in my classes before, you've seen something similar, but I'm going to be changing up the questions, because what I want to know from you is this a viable way to teach? Because the method that I've created is a little bit of an introduction, which is where we are now. And then I go into a lecture of some sort that's related to one of the classes. And then I might do something that's on my mind, you know, like a podcast kind of style segment. And then I might do another lecture. And then I close it with a wellness activity. That's what I've been doing recently. So that's what I've been experimenting with to see if it's an effective way of teaching. The problem that I have, though, is that not very many of you have been listening or watching. And so that's a concern. So as I produce this podcast for this particular week, I'm going to post a companion announcement to go along with it, because I'm not quite sure everyone knows where to look to find the podcast. But you should be subscribed to Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, subscribe to the podcast. There's a lot of information that I share on a regular basis, and I hope that you're not missing it. So that is a concern that I hope we can remedy as I figure out what we're going to call this thing and how to process the pedagogy, and then how we're going to study its effectiveness, because it's what I want to look at moving forward as we move into the next academic year. So with that, I hope that you are doing well. It is April 24th, 2024, is a Wednesday. And before we get started into our stuff for today, what I want to do is call out some of my students, our students, our fellow learners that we have in our classes. Bernardina Afolabi, who is presenting today at the Texas Women's Research Symposium. We have the symposium on campus today. She is presenting tonight her study on burnout and anxiety. She looked at teacher burnout and stress related to an F-rated campus, and why teachers might be leaving that campus. So very proud of her, sponsored her project. So she'll be presenting later this evening. And then three other students, learners from our 6433 class, Melissa Reese, Crystal Lane Cox, and Erica Scott, are all presenting this afternoon at the symposium. They're looking at the impact of the teacher incentive allotment on teacher retention. So that was their study. So very proud of them, excited to be their sponsor, looking forward to seeing their poster presentations later today. And as you, whether you're in the master's program or the doctoral program, you will always hear me talk about the importance of doing some sort of research, getting published, getting presentations, especially if you want to be in academia, if you want to be in some level of higher education. This is what we do. We spend a lot of time researching, doing presentations, publishing in journals, and this is our job. This is what is to disseminate and create new learning, new knowledge, new information. It's a constant grind. So you're going to hear me talk about it, especially in the doctoral program. And I want to publish with you. I want to show you how to do that. In fact, somewhere here in this notebook right here, I have a list of a lot of journals. These are all journals that I'm going to have typed up and posted for you, so that you can have an opportunity to marry your research with the appropriate journal. And I want to show you how to do that. All of us in the teacher education department, in the doctoral program, we want to show you how to do that. So that being said, I want to get into, since we're talking about research, first thing that's on my mind is this concept that's called positionality. I wanted to talk a little bit about what is positionality. So positionality is basically who you are and where you're standing. my position, my positionality is. But your positionality is often shaped by a lot of factors that you're both conscious of and unconscious of. So let me give you an example. Let's just take me. I am a white cisgender male. That's who I am. That's my positionality. That is my worldview. I start from that point. Those are the things that you can see and know about me that I've been willing to share and is obvious to you. There are other parts of my positionality that are not so obvious to you. For example, my economic background is not obvious to you. You can make assumptions, but it's not obvious to you unless I share that with you. My religious background is also not obvious to you unless I share that with you. My family circumstances is another positionality that is not obvious to you unless I share that with you. And I have many times. I'm married, I have a son, baseball is a big part of our life. So you know a lot of those things about me. And then there are other aspects of positionality that maybe we don't openly share, but have impacted and shaped us, shaped our experiences, our life experiences, our work experiences, our friendships and relationship experiences. That is what shapes our positionality. Now, whether you're conscious of it or not, okay, those factors, and I've said this many times in our master's program, those factors lend to your leadership style. They inform your leadership style. They shape your leadership style. So that's why in those classes, especially the early master's program classes you take with me, I ask you to explore your positionality in various ways. I don't necessarily call it positionality in that class, because positionality is more of a research term, but exploring where you stand, where you come from, your background, because we're not always conscious that those aspects of our life and the things that have shaped us, whether it's our experience and so on, lend to our positionality, okay? Now, I talk about positionality because it's important, okay? Not only as we explore our leadership and where we're headed, and as we lead programs or departments or schools, et cetera, the important thing to note is that that's your leaping frog point of view, okay? It informs your decision-making. It drives your line of thinking, okay? Now, how does this blend into research? Well, because positionality, because it's that leapfrog point, you already have a point of view. Before you even sit down and write that literature review, start that research, do that data collection, you have already formulated hypothesis, you have already made assumptions, you already have this line of thinking, and I don't want to call it a mindset, that's a whole separate concept. I'm talking about where you stand. And generally, we might call this just your peripheral worldview. Okay, it's another way of thinking about it, but the official term is positionality. So it's important to recognize our positionality and where we are, and what the things that we're conscious of and the things that we're unconscious of. To explore that positionality is very, very important, because it's going to inform where your research goes. It also informs the things that you're interested in. Okay, as you begin to really develop the insights that drive you as an individual, that's what opens up the doors to your research. So I bring all this up for two reasons, two very important reasons. One is that if you haven't really had a chance to dig deep inside of your conscious and unconscious and subconscious, if you haven't had a chance to do that, I encourage you to do that, okay? In the master's courses, I've asked students to do this through what we call an autoethnography, which is basically sitting down, writing a little bit of your life story, what led you to this point, and then what led you to a decision point to become a school leader, to go into school leadership, to get a master's degree in leadership, because that's what we do. That is a way of exploring who we are and what makes us tick, in a sense. For the doctoral side, positionality, this is the second reason. If you haven't figured out the things that you're interested in studying, knowing about, learning more about, if you haven't figured that out yet, and that's perfectly okay, I swear, I think I change my research agenda every year. It feels like I do. But if you haven't figured that out yet, your positionality is going to lend to where your research is, where you want your research to go. Okay? So what I encourage you to do, and this is, you know, I get it, the end of the semester, we're about 2 weeks out, and then summer is coming. Some of you are going to take classes, some of you are going to go on vacation. I'm actually going to do both. I'll be teaching this summer, but my family and I are taking a big trip that we have saved up for, and we're going to Greece and Italy, and we're excited and we're looking forward to that. So, you know, a large portion of July, I'm going to be on vacation. So taking time for yourself is super important, but if you haven't really truly discovered your positionality, who you are and what makes you tick, I encourage you, get a journal like this. Just get a notebook. Put pen to paper and begin to write down some concepts about yourself that are truly important. Things you love, things that you believe in, things that matter to you. Those things shape your positionality, which will ultimately shape your research and ultimately shapes your worldview. Now, I'm not saying that your positionality can't change. I said in last week's podcast, I subscribe to the new information, new opinion point of view. As the information changes, I reserve the right to change my opinion because I have an informed opinion. I don't have a willy-nilly opinion. I have an informed opinion. The opinions that I have on topics ranging from politics to religion to research are all shaped by information, credible information. I talked a lot about that in the last podcast. So I subscribe to that. So your positionality can certainly change as you gain and learn new information, not only externally, but about yourself. So positionality is an important concept that I think all of us need to stop, think, and explore, especially if you're going to be in education and if you're going to be in higher education, because it is a concept that I think that is important and unique to us all. Soundstripe. Soundstripe. So the next big thing that I want to talk about is this past weekend on April 20th, we had the anniversary, 25 years of since the Columbine shooting that happened in Columbine, Colorado, suburb of Denver. Not going to lend any credence to the shooters of that. If you want to know, you can look it up. School shootings are, I'm pretty passionate about these things. I've been very vocal about my position on we have not done enough to make our schools safer related to school shootings. Yes, things have been done, but we haven't done enough. 13 people were killed in Columbine. We had 26 killed in Sandy Hook. We had 10 killed in Santa Fe outside of Houston. We had 17 killed in Parkland, Florida. We had 21 killed in Uvalde. And there are more, and there are others. Oxford in Michigan, for example. Those parents were just convicted of allowing their student to have a gun. They bought the gun for him, okay? So they should go to jail, and that's my opinion on that. And I'm not going to apologize for it, but children dying in our schools should not be happening. I want our government to do more. We celebrate guns way too much in this country, and it needs to stop. And I'm only talking about school shootings. I'm not even talking about the things that have happened in, say, Las Vegas, or acts of violence that happen that we consider mass shootings, but you know, maybe only 3 or 4 or 5 people died. Not acceptable, but because they're not large numbers, they may not get the media coverage that our school shootings often get. And in the wake of the Nashville shooting that happened a year ago, where someone walked into a private school and did some horrible things, Tennessee decides to arm teachers. That's their response. That's the wrong response. You got it wrong, Tennessee. You absolutely got this one wrong. Arming teachers. Okay, so a kindergarten classroom, you now have an armed teacher. Congratulations. You didn't think that through. You're not listening to research. You're not listening to experts. You're bowing down to political ideology, and it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. So what we have now in the anniversary of Columbine, and a lot of things were good that came out of Columbine. First of all, the awareness, because we didn't really have anything like this before. Sure, we had Kent State in the 1960s, and then there was the UT shooting in the 1960s, and there were other incidents in the 80s, but nothing like this. And media was blamed for it. Video games were blamed for it. In fact, there's a book that was turned into a movie called Basketball Diaries, written by a basketball prodigy. His name escapes me right now. It was basically his diary as he was playing basketball and some of the things that he wished would happen. And in that, he has this dream sequence, and you'll see Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie wearing a trench coat and going through and eliminating members of a classroom using an automatic weapon. That was blamed for that. And perhaps maybe that's where the shooters got the idea for Columbine, or it influenced them, enhanced them. I don't know. I don't want to know. It doesn't matter. Those individuals are no longer with us. The point is the good things that did come from it is awareness, increased security, increased development of the importance of mental health, whether it be students that are troubled that could go down a path of school shootings, or supporting individuals and creating a better, stronger awareness of mental health challenges that are happening in both teachers and students. These are diseases, and they're real, and they're important, and they have to be dealt with. And the science is clear. The research is clear that we need help, and they need help to support. I want to point out two organizations that have also been developed in the wake of not only Columbine's, but some of these other shootings, that I want to encourage you to visit, take some time, look at it, increase your own education and awareness on these issues. The first one is called SafeSchoolsForAlex.org. Now, SafeSchoolsForAlex.org was developed out of the horrible shooting in Parkland, Florida, which I've said in the past that hits home for me, because Parkland is my second home. My wife is from Parkland. Her parents still live there. It's where we go for vacation. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas is about 2 miles from my mother-in-law's house in Parkland. And my nieces will attend that school. I have a niece who's a freshman there. So that hit close to home. And so one of the parents who lost a child in Parkland, which should not have happened, but it did, has gone and created SafeSchoolsForAlex.org so he can increase awareness and create what he calls a school safety dashboard. And on this dashboard, it's to help with resources and contact and information, and also so that schools can keep track of the incidents that are happening, the impact. It's basically a database where parents can go and see how safe the schools are in a particular area and what those states are doing to eliminate violence and gun violence on their campuses. So I encourage you to check that out. It's important information, and it's amazing work that is happening in Alex's name. The second one, and I've pointed this one out before, is the K-12 school shooting database. Yes, such a thing exists, and that is K-12SSDB.org, and I'll post all of these later. When you go to the front page, and I'm looking at it now, this is the number of people killed in active shooter attacks in schools each year. And you can see right here how many people were killed. You can look at the data. And it shows exactly where we are with school shooting deaths and gun violence in America. And it's gone up, unfortunately. They track incidences, they track victims, they track deaths, and their data is up to date to through 2023. I mean, we're only, you know, 4 months into 2024, but we've had 348 incidences last year. There were 249 victims and 71 people died. That's 2023 in a nutshell. So I encourage you to take a look at this. They also break it down by state, which states have had the most school shooting incidences. California leads, probably because they have 50 million people. But you get to see also where these incidents occur. They break it down by parking lots, hallways, cafeteria, and so on. So it's really good data to take a look at. It's interesting. But I'm not going to stop talking about this at all. It's going to be something that I'm going to continue to have a very strong opinion that children should not be dying in our schools. Teachers should not be dying in our schools. We need to be doing more to educate, to create an understanding that guns do not need to be near our children. They do not need to be in our schools. And we've got to do more to protect children and families from these tragedies from occurring. And I was very vocal about my opinions on House Bill 3 here in Texas. That's been in a previous podcast. I encourage you to go back and listen to my thoughts on that. So while, you know, things are being done, they're certainly not enough. And there are more things that can be done to prevent these levels of gun violence in our country. So I want to honor the victims of Columbine with this. As probably the largest premier school shooting, the first real one that kind of captured America's attention, unfortunately. And the 25th anniversary of that was this past weekend. So I want to just God bless those families and the victims and the lives that could have been had over the last 25 years that are lost to horrific, unfortunate, unnecessary, and just stupid gun violence. Take a turn now and talk a little bit about school leadership and campus management. This has been a large, wide topic, particularly in my 23 class that we've been talking about, systems thinking. And systems thinking is a part of campus management that I think is a little bit overlooked. So I want to break it down for you and talk about systems thinking, because when you become a school leader of any sort, assistant principal or principal, you have to have a concept of systems thinking. And what that basically means is it's making sense of complexity. The world is a very complex place. And as I've always said, particularly in the political realm, everything to me is a shade of gray. It's not black, it's not white, it's not this, it's not that. It's not left, it's not right, it's not red, it's not blue. It is somewhere in the middle. It's really just sort of a shade of gray somewhere in the middle. And when you're a systems thinker, you take the complex parts of the world and looking at them in terms of whole things and relationships, how one whole relates to another whole, and you explore how those complex wholes interact and react to one another. There's a really great activity back in the days when we taught face-to-face And I would have graduate students in a room with me that I would do. I called it complex pieces, and it's a borrowed activity, but it's a great activity. And basically what I would do is just sort of visualize this, if you can, whether you're listening or watching on YouTube, is you take a bunch of people and you just kind of scatter them around. Just do a scatter drill in a room, and they're all scattered, and you have all these people walking around. And then at some point you say, stop. Okay, so all the individuals stop. And then you tell the individual to, in their mind's eye, don't look at them directly, but don't make eye contact, but in your mind's eye, think of two people in the room. Just think of two people in the room. And so you give them a second to do that. And so everybody in the room is thinking of two people that are in that room. Okay, and then you ask them, okay, now, when I say go, you have to move where you are equidistant from both of those individuals. So you have to pinpoint yourself in the room to make sure that you are equidistant, same distance between both individuals that you thought of in your mind's eye. And so that means if they move, you move. And if the other person moves, then you move, and everybody will then shift. And so you say go, and then what you'll see is this complex shifting of people moving, shuffling their feet, watching the two people, seeing as they move, because what's great about it is that the two people that they chose also chose two people and two people and so on. So they're also watching where those other people are going. And as they shift and move, the room might expand, it might contract, and it becomes this complex, weird people organism that is sort of moving and shaking and shaping in the room. And ultimately, after probably 30 seconds, 60 seconds or so of all that moving and shifting, and it'll settle and it'll stop. And you'll have this entire room now that has moved equidistant to one another. Okay, so now you're not done with the activity, because what's great about it is, as the leader of this activity, you then go in and you tell somebody, hey, go stand in the corner, or hey, leave the room, or hey, go to the center of the room, something. Just tell that one person, and then that person moves because you asked them to, and then obviously the entire system then begins to shape and move again, because you have moved one piece, one person has then moved in or out of the circle or even out of the room completely. And it is a way to demonstrate the complexity of the multiple systems that can occur within an organization, and how just moving one piece, and maybe even two pieces, can impact the entire organism, and it can infect and affect everything that's happening. So it's a great visual to show the importance and significance of systems thinking. And what I think it does is it allows us to ask better questions without jumping to conclusions, without just immediately jumping in and like, well, this has to change. We've got to get in there and we got to move this person, move this program, fire this person, whatever. And it involves more than just looking at a little bit of data and jumping to some conclusions that you probably shouldn't jump to. Because being a systems thinker, particularly in a school, you don't realize the tiniest impact that something can have on the entire organization. Case in point, when I was a very, very, very young administrator, one of the things that I did was I had this bright idea as a second year assistant principal in an elementary school. We'll just change the schedule. That'll solve our problem, whatever problem we were having at the time. We'll just change the schedule. We'll just adjust it. We'll just move things around by, 15, 20 minutes. And the next thing you know, that impacted lunch. It impacted recess. It impacted teacher conference times. It impacted specials when students were going to go to PE and art and music. And we were also trying to implement this technology time. So it was going to impact that. And so next thing you know, we're having lunch at 10 a.m. and and kids are going to recess at 8:30 in the morning, and then they're stuck in their room the rest of the day. It was a horrible thing. And it taught me very early on that, okay, one little tinkering, one little thing can have this ultimate large impact on the entire organization, as it were. So it's important as a leader to have that systems thinking mindset, so that you're not jumping to conclusions, and you're just you have this understanding that things have an interconnectedness, and that you may or may not be conscious of. There, anytime you plug out or disconnect a piece, you're gonna have some sort of disruption. So that leads to the next thing that I think is important for you to understand is that as a school leader, you might feel this pressure to need to want to have to know everything that's going on. And you don't have to. You don't have to be the premier expert on everything, okay? Yes, have a working knowledge of most things. Of course, you need to do that. But, and I've said before in many podcasts that when I started working in elementary, to expect me to be an expert in 5-6 grade levels and 5 or 6 subject areas, that is just not appropriate. And there's no way any one individual can have that strong of understanding of that kind of curriculum at all. So, but it's okay to surround yourself with people that do. Now, I wasn't strong when it came to instruction. I know what good instruction looks like, but maybe I don't know what good instruction looks like in a bilingual classroom. So I have someone to help me with that. I have someone I could rely on to go, let's do this walkthrough together. Tell me what you see. I'll tell you what I see. And maybe what I'm seeing looks bad, but is unique to the instruction of that particular classroom because I don't have that level of understanding. That's okay. That's okay. And it goes back to what I said in an earlier segment about being informed. So having people around you that can help you make informed decisions so that you don't mess up the entire organization by poor decision making. It's okay to not know, but it's not okay to not ask questions before you make significant changes. So being a systems thinker is really, really important to classroom management, campus management. And you just have to have a good understanding and an idea of how things are connected, how things work together, and surround yourself with people that can help you in those decision makings so that you don't have to feel like you gotta know everything, because you don't. You just have to be the leader that makes the ultimate best decision for everybody. Now, before we get into our next topic, I want to add this disclaimer that I am a white male, and that's pretty obvious to all of you. But for those of you who are not watching, I want to let you know that I'm a white male. So going back to our previous segment about positionality, I'm probably the last person on the face of the earth that should be talking about this topic. But I want to talk a little bit about gender leadership, specifically for my 6433 class. And to be at Texas Women's University, I think it's important that we do address the elephant in the room. And that is that there are not enough women leaders in positions of power in this country, period, end of story, okay? Now, I'm not saying that because I'm somehow paid to say that or because I work at a women's institution. I'm saying that because it's true. Now, a strong majority of Americans, about 75%, say women and men equally make great political leaders. But look at Congress makeup. There's not enough women there. There's just simply not. Now, the question is why? Now, there's a multiple studies out there on the effects of gender on leadership. And if this is a topic that interests you a little bit more, I encourage you just to do a quick Google study, even a Google Scholar search, and just look up gender leadership or women in leadership so you can get a sense on why this is important. Now, here's one reason why. Men, male leaders, tend to make decisions based on personal rights, justice, and fairness, while women generally look at things like ethics, sensitivity, empathy, compassion. Those are two very different ways to approach situations. So it matters. And again, it ties back to what we've been talking about positionality. Where you stand, where you're from, your experiences, the experiences of women is important when it comes to decision making. And those voices need to be heard. They absolutely do. Female leaders tend to be more cautious than their male counterparts, but particularly in decision making. And even 55%, I'm just looking at this, 55% of Americans say there's too few women in top executive business positions. But that's down a little bit. I mean, our university exists to empower women. That's why we're here. And it's important that we have women who are rising up in positions, not only that have been noted as traditionally for women, like nursing and education. And I'm hoping that's changing, because we have new generations of people who don't necessarily see certain professions as only for women anymore. But we work very hard at Texas Women's to empower women to be a part of organizations that maybe aren't gender friendly, that have been male dominated. We need more women in politics. We need more women in educational leadership positions. We don't have enough. We have so many women that enter education as teachers and counselors and so on, but then they stay. And they stay for a variety of factors, mostly because they're caregivers of their own families, or they're not giving those opportunities to rise up into leadership positions, largely because they don't have time. Those leadership positions require master's degrees or higher level degrees. And because they're stuck raising families, they don't get a chance to increase their own education to move into those positions. And that's unfortunate. So we don't have enough women in leadership positions in educational leadership. We don't have enough women in politics, which is important, as is some of the data that I just shared with you. And we don't have enough women who are leading some of our organizations that need to make decisions about the economy and jobs, progress, innovation, and so on. We still have a women in STEM problem, and it's 2024. We need more women to take on science and math positions so that we can increase our knowledge in engineering and mathematics and science careers. We just need that. It's important. But a lot of this stems from generational gender stereotypes that women are somehow lesser than men because, they're not as smart or they're not as capable or not as great at leadership. And all of that's bunk. It's wrong. What's sad is that we had to research it to find out. That's terrible. But a lot of when it comes to gender leadership is driven by cultural identity. And as you know, there are countries in this world that the cultural identity of that country alone does not give women the same rights as men, especially when it comes to leadership positions or other important factors about, you know, running the country or heck, even driving. I remember years ago, my aunt and my uncle lived in Saudi Arabia for a year or two, working over there and spending some time. My aunt, who had been driving her entire life, wasn't allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia. She had to relinquish a lot of her Americanisms and a lot of her American rights as a female when she went to another country because she was a lower class citizen. That's wrong. It's inappropriate. You're hearing a lot of this discussion in the sports world right now. If you haven't heard, if you're not a big basketball fan, Caitlin Clark has just lit up the NCAA women's basketball arena. She set all kinds of records. And she even broke the all-time scoring record for both men and women. Ratings were through the roof watching her and move through the NCAA tournament. And ultimately, Iowa would lose, but the real winner was women's sports and women athletics. It's amazing. And now she's going to go play in the WNBA. She was the number one overall pick. And last time I checked and I heard, the ticket sales are through the roof. They're having to move games to larger arenas to account because everyone wants to see Caitlin Clark. You're talking about a generational player that has come in and changed the game. But what I love about Caitlin Clark is she makes everyone around her better. She seems to be like a humble individual, and She's only going to make $75,000 playing a professional sport. Now, I'm not going to get into revenue sharing and collective bargaining agreements. I'll leave that for all the sports pundits. But what is amazing about Caitlin Clark is the impact and influence that she is having on a generation of little girls who are watching her play and moving through sports world today, giving them a hero, giving them someone that they can look up to and saying, you know what, I'm a girl, I play basketball, I want to be like Caitlin Clark. That's great. We need more of that. But where we need it is in education, in politics, corporations, entertainment. We need more high-profile women leaders in those positions so there's a generation of little girls looking up and saying, I can be president, I can be CEO, I can be an engineer, I can own my own production company. That's what we need. And we shouldn't be talking about this in 2024, but clearly we are. And it's a conversation that needs to continue and needs to be had. So what we need to do is we need to talk openly about the gender gaps, the gender pay gaps, civil rights gaps that women still have to deal with today. And we need to empower other women and men to stand up and say, it's not right. We need more women equality. We need more women voices in all of these arenas, and we need to grow women leaders. And I'm proud to work at Texas Women's University. This is the best job I have ever had. I have said that out loud to anyone who is willing to hear me talk about it. I love this university. I love this mission and what we're able to do for students, and I am glad to be a part of it. There's a lot of great women and men, students that we have, and I'm proud to be a part of their growth and their leadership. But we need more. We need more. We need more. So empower others, talk to others, share stories with others, get the information out there. That way we can hopefully change the narrative as we produce future generations that have to say, you know what? Equality is for everyone. It's for everyone. No matter where your background is or your positionality, we need opportunities for everyone. Soundstripe. Next segment I want to run through is just sort of some education headlines that I have that I've collected over the last couple of weeks, and I want to do this and see how this goes. And these are just some headlines that I've come across my desk. So first one, Richardson ISD is closing Richardson, Texas, closing five schools and consolidating campuses due to declines in enrollment and funding. So they're closing four elementary schools, pre-K campuses. This is in response to declining enrollment and a lack of funding from Texas legislators, which has been a common tale for quite some time. So they're struggling with keeping their enrollment where it needs to be. A few weeks ago in Keller ISD in Keller, Texas, a school board trustee had to resign after they invited a film crew to come inside of one of their high schools and film without the school district's permission. Parents of students say the incident violated student privacy rights, school security, and they're calling for another trustee to resign. That film crew was like an evangelist film crew, and they were coming in and doing some stuff. They were from another country, too, so that was a horrible thing. Parents are worried about their kids' mental health, and they think schooling options and changing their schooling locations might be the option to fix that. Parents who are considering changing or adjusting their children's schooling situation say mental health is a leading factor in their decision. School dress codes often target girls. We just had a large conversation about gender equity. So what happens when male teachers have to enforce school dress code policies that target skirt length
or bare midriffs and shoulders often disproportionately affect female students.
I had this conversation with some of my graduate students earlier. I think dress codes are disproportionately biased towards females. If you look at the dress codes, I just think that they're more restrictive to what girls can wear than what boys can wear, and I don't think that's right. I think maybe we ought to look at our dress codes in this country might be a little archaic. So
lack of guidance and training for educators says enforcing dress codes leaves them, particularly male teachers, vulnerable to accusations of discrimination, sexual harassment, and can distance them from students to engage in learning. So
I'm tired of dress code getting in the way of education, but it's something we probably ought to look at.
Low-performing schools are left to languish by districts and states, according to a report. Federal low-performing schools are left to languish. The article states that fewer than half of the district plans for improving struggling schools meet even a bare minimum requirements. It says that many of these schools appear to have been left to languish in academic doldrums without clear improvement strategies or using dedicated resources to execute and turn around these schools.
I'm not sure why. I've often complained about in this country, we basically have 51 different ways of educating students because we have 50 states in the District of Columbia, and they all have different rules and requirements. They all have different standards. They all have different funding mechanisms. So when you have a failing school, what one state decides to do with it is different than another state. And it's wrong.
Schools prioritize reading intervention, but what about math? Data confirms that schools are more likely to offer targeted instructional support and intervention in early reading instead of early math. In a 2015 study, 13 states found 71% of schools had implemented reading response to reading and intervention practices by first grade, but only 35% had done math.
That's a problem. That impacts college readiness. While reading is important, math skills are important too. It's a different kind of thinking, different kind of critical thinking. And lastly, what makes a great teacher? Pedagogy or personality?
The vibrancy we notice in excellent teachers may be a combination of both a skilled pedagogy and highly developed awareness of the teacher's presence, emotions, and needs, and the consciousness to attend to them as well as what we want to do for our students. So
there are headlines, education headlines. As we wrap up today, here's our wellness activity. What I want you to do is I want you to just try your best. Pick a day this week, next week. Have a device-free evening. No phone, no iPad, no tablet, no computer, no desktop. Sure, watch TV. But maybe get off your phone for a little bit. Unplug. You know, pick a time, say dinner time or 6 p.m. or something like that. And you just take your phone, and you put it on mute, turn it off, plug it in, put it away, and just have an evening for yourself. You're gonna thank me. Have a device-free evening. Just do yourself a favor and give yourself permission to not check text messages, social media, email, and just walk away from it for one night. Just give yourself one night of a mental break from anything related to social media, cell phones, text messaging, emails, etc. You'll feel better. Unplug, give yourself a 12, 15 hour break from technology. You'll thank yourself and you'll thank yourself. With that, thank you for listening today. Thank you for watching. I hope everyone's doing well. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. We will see you soon.